This is a special report from NPR News. Hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Judge Michael Mukasey to be the next Attorney General. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The second day of the Mukasey hearings revisited many of the topics raised on the first day, but this time Judge Mukasey seemed more in tune with the Bush administration, especially on questions of executive power. For the most part, he resisted senators' efforts to go into deeper detail on sensitive subjects like the use of torture. We're setting aside a substantial part of this hour for that discussion. Also, there were more questions on the administration's program of warrantless wiretaps, all the subjects really about the limits of presidential power. On the second day, Judge Mukasey appeared to retreat from some of his previous statements and to draw only the barest outlines of his views on the struggles between the Congress and the White House on presidential power. We're bringing you a compressed version of a hearing that went on for several hours, and we're going to begin, as the committee did, with questions from the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy pursued a topic discussed on the first day of the hearings. Judge Mukasey had answered a question about holding administration officials in contempt if they refuse to comply with congressional requests for information, citing executive privilege. Executive privilege is a loosely defined principle that all presidents must be able to do what they do without having Congress looking over their shoulder all the time. Mukasey said the Department of Justice should move against officials on contempt charges if they believe the claim of executive privilege is unreasonable. Senator Leahy said the standard should be whether or not the claim of privilege is valid. So let's talk a little bit about this, Leahy said.
Congress were to refer a contempt citation, and there is a real probability there will be some as a result of the U.S. attorney scandal. You're indicating that the U.S. attorney would undertake an independent analysis and assess the claim of privilege in determining whether to bring the matter before a grand jury. Is that right?
Well, let me flesh out a little bit what I understand the process to be and to have been, and maybe put a little bit of flesh on the bones of my answer. As I understand it, when the White House gets a subpoena, they refer it to the Department of Justice, as in fact happened here, because I was shown a letter from Paul Clement relating to the assertion of the privilege. If the White House then, relying on that letter, I mean, if the president, since he is the only person who owns the privilege, if he, relying on the Justice Department, asserts the privilege, and there is nonetheless a contempt citation, we're in the position where the Department of Justice would have to prosecute someone who followed the advice that originated with the Department of Justice. I'm told that there are not one but two opinions of the Office of Legal Counsel saying that that would not be appropriate.
But Chairman Leahy pressed on.
We have a bit of a problem here because some of these claims were extremely broad. You had people can't even testify and say, I never talked to the president. I never sent stuff to the president. The president never asked me any questions, never interacted with me. But I'm claiming executive privilege. Now, that seems kind of a broad claim.
As you describe it, it sounds broad, but I think the executive privilege covers communications other than those directly to and from the president. There's a whole range of interests that have to be protected by executive privilege that include setting aside matters of national security, setting aside matters of current litigation.
What if the president broke the law and somebody wanted to look into it? He said, wait a minute, executive privilege. We can't have anybody talk about what I did breaking the law because I claim executive privilege.
I think part of the content of what it is in the communication has to be considered. There's a weighing process that goes on.
We have with us in the studio NPR's Nina Totenberg, our legal affairs correspondent, and NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Nina, this was indeed a very different tone from yesterday. What do you make of it?
Well, there are several ways to look at it. You could look at it this way, which is that the nominee got sort of taken to the woodshed by the administration operatives last night, who said, you weren't singing from the same page we were. Or you could say that the Democrats read the newspapers and looked like patsies and decided they were going to be tougher. Or you could say that Mr. Mukasey read the newspapers and thought that he had been too accommodating.
I wonder, Ron, could I ask you for a second about the executive privilege claim? That's a label we pin on most disputes between Congress and the administration, memorably in the time of Watergate, but before that and since then?
Yes. Richard Nixon was, of course, the person who gave it its greatest notoriety in our time in a desperate attempt to disentangle himself from Watergate. And by claiming it hither and yon and broadly, he tended to discredit the very concept of it and therefore to devalue it for future presidents. So since then, while every president has had occasion to make some reference to his need, practical need, to keep certain things confidential, most of them have tried to stay away from using the exact phrase executive privilege, including the Bush administration in its first several years. More recently, of course, as things have gotten much more direct, the seeking of documents, the seeking of testimony, then the administration has said, well, what we're talking about here is executive privilege.
An executive privilege obtains when you're talking about any kind of document or communication, which could be said to be involved in the formation of policy.
Yes, and the White House makes the broad argument that if they cannot have the confidentiality of advice from a broad number of individuals brought into the White House, either as employees or advisors.
Good advice and bad advice, which they may take or not take.
But in any event, confidential advice, so that the individual feels unfettered in giving the best opinion that individual can give and does not worry about being dragged before some congressional committee under hot lights and interrogated.
Thanks, Ron. After pursuing the issue of executive privilege, Senator Leahy got to the heart of what was behind most of today's session with this question about the limits or lack of limits on presidential power.
Can a president authorize illegal conduct? Can a president put somebody above the law by authorizing illegal conduct?
So I just checked. They're going to do out there.
The only way for me to respond to that in the abstract is to say that if by illegal you mean contrary to a statute, but within the authority of the president to defend the country, the president is not putting somebody above the law. The president is putting somebody within the law. Can the president put somebody above the law? No, the president doesn't stand above the law. But the law emphatically includes the Constitution. It starts with the Constitution.
We'll go back to this. I'm troubled by your answer. I see a loophole big enough to drive a truck through, and so we'll go back to it. We'll go back to it.
And we will go back to it too, especially as it involves torture and domestic wiretapping without warrants. But before we do, Nina, let me ask you, what did he mean about the president not putting someone above the law, but putting someone within the law? It's artfully stated. What does it mean?
I think what he meant was, if this is a power of the president under the Constitution, even if it's illegal under a statute, the president's powers under the Constitution are greater than statutory powers, or at least there may be what he called in one place a gap. And that, therefore, the president can trump a law when he views it as trampling on his powers as president of the United States.
And the most of the powers that they talk about in this that derive from the Constitution in this way are his powers as commander-in-chief, specifically in wartime.
Well, some of them are, but some of them are his powers to execute the laws of the land. But most of them in wartime involve his commander-in-chief powers. Now, there are some sort of refuges in all of this. For example, in the conversation about wiretapping, the administration and the nominee both say, well, it's not just the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act at stake here. It's because of the authorization for use of military force. That, in essence, authorized us to go beyond FISA, what's called FISA. Well, the senators weren't buying that, not even the Republican senators.
It's Ron. Fair to say, in context here, that this administration has asserted almost from the very beginning, certainly since 9/11, the right under the second article of the Constitution, the president's power as a commander-in-chief, to do extraordinary things to defend the country, as we heard Michael Mukasey say, to defend the country, even in the absence of wartime. We do not have a declaration of war today. The United States has not been in a state of war since 1945.
But the president talks frequently about the war on terror, as
yes.
if that...
Yes, because he wants to invoke the same notion of authority accruing to him that he would have under a declaration of war. But formally, technically, we have not had a state of war for that long, and the president is asserting these powers nonetheless as emanating generally from Article II and his powers as the commander-in-chief. That is a rather wide loophole.
And it is this an extraordinary assertion, Nina?
Well, he goes back to the authorization for use of military force, which he takes to be the equivalent of a declaration of war. Now, senator after senator today said, look, I thought I was just voting for the invasion of Afghanistan. I never thought I was voting for wiretapping. I never thought I was voting to give you all of these powers. And if you wanted to have those powers, you needed to make it explicit. And then we would have agreed to it or not agreed to it.
Everyone who listens to this entire hour should be entitled to a certificate from the Linda Wertheimer Correspondence School of Law. Thank you both very much. Coming up, we're going to hear some arguments on the question of torture. Please stay with us. From NPR News, this is a special report on the confirmation of Judge Michael Mukasey to be the next Attorney General. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The Senate Committee on the Judiciary spent a fairly contentious second day of hearings pressing Judge Mukasey for his views on controversial subjects, nearly all related to what kind of power the president has and whether or not the Congress can lawfully and properly restrain that power. The hottest topic in this area was torture, exploring the president's decision to authorize some extreme forms of interrogation in the name of national security with the authority presidents have as commanders-in-chief, and the Congress's efforts to pass laws to prevent torture, laws some members of the committee clearly feel are being ignored by this administration. Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, the ranking Republican on the committee, introduced the topic early in the day. It came right after hearing what Judge Mukasey told Senator Leahy about presidential powers in general, about not putting people above the law, but putting them within the law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Picking up on this issue, you testified yesterday that the president could not order torture because it would violate a statute. In light of your answer a moment ago, would you say that is because the president does not have Article II power to protect the country to authorize torture?
President can't authorize torture because torture is barred both by statute and by the Constitution. And I'd be happy to walk back through that if you wish.
Well, where in the Constitution is torture barred?
It's barred by the Fifth, the 14th, and the Eighth Amendments. The Fifth and the 14th Amendments bar conduct that shocks the conscience. They've been so interpreted.
We're going to step out of chronological order here and spend some time on this particular topic, torture, and defining torture. Toward the end of the morning of the second day, Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois picked up the issue.
We had questions yesterday about the issue of torture under the Geneva Conventions. The techniques which have been attributed to this administration involve painful stress positions, threatening detainees with dogs, forced nudity, waterboarding, that is simulated drowning, and mock execution. When we had the judge advocates general testify, I asked point blank whether they believe that these techniques violated the Geneva Conventions. They said yes. And I asked if they felt if those techniques were used against an American detainee, they would be violative of the Geneva Conventions. And they answered in the affirmative. What is your opinion?
I'm certainly not in a position here to argue with a judge advocate general's view that they violate the Geneva Conventions, and that whether used against us or against anybody else, that they would. That said, I think we have to also recognize that when we're talking about coercive methods of interrogation, this is not a matter of choosing pleasant alternatives over unpleasant alternatives or good alternatives over bad alternatives. It's a choice among bad alternatives. What the experience is of people in the Judge Advocate General's Corps, who are enormously well-disciplined and very skilled, what that experience has been with captured soldiers, captured military people from enemies we fought in the past, may very well be far different from the experience that we're having with unlawful combatants who we face now. It's a very different kind of person.
Durbin tried a couple of times to clarify that point with Mukasey and finally concluded with this, and you'll hear the chairman, Patrick Leahy, jump in at the end of Durbin's exchange.
Let me try to bring it to the bottom line because I want to make sure that if there is common ground, we find it. If not, that it's clear on the record. I want to understand, as to these interrogation techniques, whether you believe that they would constitute torture and therefore could not be used against any detainee, military or otherwise, by the United States government.
I don't think that I can responsibly talk about any technique here because of the very... I'm not going to discuss, and I should not, I'm sorry I can't discuss, and I think it would be irresponsible of me to discuss particular techniques with which I am not familiar when there are people who are using coercive techniques and who are being authorized to use coercive techniques. And for me to say something that is going to put their careers or freedom at risk simply because I want to be congenial. I don't think it would be responsible of me to do that.
This is not a congeniality contest, and I'm sorry that I've gone over, Mr. Chairman. But, for instance, I just want to, if I can make one last point, on the issue of waterboarding, simulated drowning. The United States has long taken the position that this is a war crime. In 1901, a U.S. Army Major, Edwin Glenn, sentenced to 10 years hard labor for waterboarding a captured insurgent in the Philippines. U.S. military commissions after World War II prosecuted Japanese troops for engaging in waterboarding. The torture statute makes it a crime to threaten someone with imminent death. Waterboarding is a threat of imminent death. I'm hoping that you can at least look at this one technique and say that clearly constitutes torture. It should not be the policy of the United States to engage in waterboarding, whether the detainee is military or otherwise.
It is not constitutional for the United States to engage in torture in any form, be it waterboarding or anything else.
But take that as your answer. I'll allow the chairman.
Well, I make
up.
Sure I fully understand, but I wrote down about three different times you said, unless it is authorized. Are you saying that techniques can be authorized that are not constitutional?
No, that is emphatically not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that techniques can be authorized that are beyond the Army Field Manual, and I should not get into a discussion of what they might be or in what combination they might be authorized.
But if they, simply because something is authorized, if you have a law that says that it is torture and is not allowed, is there any way it could be still authorized?
If it is torture as defined in the Constitution, or as defined by constitutional standards, it can't be authorized. We don't have the Nuremberg defense here.
Is the current statute outlawing torture constitutional?
I believe it is.
It was not quite over. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat of Rhode Island, took his turn next.
Just to finish that thought, so is waterboarding constitutional?
I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture, torture is not constitutional.
If waterboarding is constitutional, is a massive hedge.
No, I said if it's torture. I'm sorry, I said if it's torture.
If it's torture, that's a massive hedge. I mean, it either is or it isn't. Do you have an opinion on whether waterboarding, which is the practice of putting somebody in a reclining position, strapping them down, putting cloth over their faces, and pouring water over the cloth to simulate the feeling of drowning, is that constitutional?
If it amounts to torture, it is not constitutional.
I'm very disappointed in that answer. I think it is purely semantic.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, the judge said there. At the very end of the second day's hearing, the chairman, Patrick Leahy, offered a kind of old country lawyer apology or explanation or perhaps a challenge to the nominee, who offered an explanation of his own. Here's Leahy.
I am concerned that on a number of your answers yesterday, there was a very bright line on questions of torture and the ability of an executive or inability of an executive to ignore the law. That seems nowhere near as bright a line today, and maybe I just don't understand. You're a lawyer from New York City. You've been a judge. I'm just a lawyer from a small state of Vermont, and I may not fully understand the nuances. But I'm going to be asking further questions because I don't know whether you received some criticism from anybody in the administration last night after your testimony, but I sense a difference, and a number of people here, Republican and Democratic alike, have sensed a difference, and I want to make sure we clear that up before we finish.
I received no criticism. I had dinner with my family last night.
You did a lot better. I did, too. I turned down a public event so I could have a quiet dinner with my family. You're probably a lot better off that way.
Well, I should also point out that you say I'm a judge from New York. I am a judge from New York, and I've watched a lot of cross-examinations. And I know the way cross-examinations proceed. You start with an easy step, and then you go down the road. I don't want to go down the road on interrogation techniques. That's obvious. Did the things that were presented to me seem over the line to me as I sit here? Of course they did. They were intended to, and they did, and they do. But part of this is it's not so much the question as it is the next question and the one after that.
The next question and the one after that. Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent and NPR senior Washington editor, are here with us in the studio. Ron Elving, let me ask you this. What about that torture question? It's not so much this question, but the next question and the one after that. What do you think? I mean, is this a hedge, as one of the senators said?
I don't think he's backing off so much as I think he's stiffening. He's being pushed and pushed, and he's beginning to push back. And he's saying, look, there may be people out in the field right now, maybe CIA, maybe somebody else working for the United States government and being told to do certain things, being authorized to do certain things, which we could get into, which might amount to torture. So if I'm going to sit here and say it's unconstitutional for the United States to torture, which is what he has been saying over and over again, and then I'm going to be questioned about certain procedures and I'm going to call them torture, I am going to be essentially indicting certain American operatives for what they are doing right now and indicting the people who are authorizing and instructing them to do it. That would be a big deal for him to sit there and say, I'm the new Attorney General if you confirm me, and I'm indicting these activities by these people and saying they're unconstitutional, they're illegal, they're in contravention of the Geneva Conventions. That would be a big deal. He's obviously not going to step over that line and not be dragged over it either.
And yet, when we're talking about waterboarding, as Admiral John Hudson, who was the Judge Advocate General for the Navy until a few years ago, as he said today, waterboarding is, other than the rack and the screw, the most iconic torture and universally repudiated kind of treatment that we have long viewed as torture, not just us, but other countries.
Oh, back to the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, it started in the Spanish Inquisition. That's when it started. That's where they came up with it. So, as you heard here, we prosecuted people for doing this, not only our enemies, but our own. So, certainly he knew he was going to be asked this question. And he made a sort of a big deal yesterday about talking about how important it was for us not to torture, that we didn't fight World War II, our soldiers didn't take pictures of the concentration camps that they discovered in Germany, for us to then engage in this kind of conduct. So this seems to me to be a fairly clear red line that he was not willing to cross even for waterboarding. And while I agree with Ron that you wouldn't expect him to do it with a bunch of other stuff, waterboarding seems to have been something that we hear that they've stopped doing it. It's so universally condemned they stopped doing it. We don't know this. There are reports of that. But we don't know this. And it just seems it's an oddity that he wasn't willing to commit on even that.
And let's grant for the moment that we have stopped doing it. Maybe we were doing some of it right after 9/11. Maybe we were doing it right after we captured certain high-value al-Qaeda figures. Maybe we've stopped doing it. But what the administration does not want to do is to give up or forestall its option of using anything that it defines other than torture in the future. That might very well include waterboarding.
So are we talking really about definitions here? I mean, is it that kind of a thing that like President Clinton and his definition of sex?
Well, in terms of torture, of course that we're talking about definitions here, because you can say to the cows come home that you're against torture, but if you don't define what it is, it's kind of a meaningless assertion.
Do you want to explain the reference that Judge Mukasey made to the Nuremberg defense? We don't have a Nuremberg defense in this country.
That's just the defense of, my boss told me to do it, so it's okay. We didn't honor that at Nuremberg. Because these were considered war crimes, and we don't have it as a defense in our law.
Now, I noticed that at the end of the day, Judge Mukasey walked up to speak to Senator Leahy after the hearing. They had a little chat, standing there as they do with one hand over the microphone so nobody else could hear it. I wonder if you think there was any sort of animosity created between these two men by today's hearing.
No, I think these are both pretty seasoned players. They each have their views. They believe them strongly. Neither one expected the other to completely back down. But they know they're going to have to work together. And to be sort of trite about this, I think they're both patriots. So I think they want to make this work, and it's not in their interest to have a feud. I expect that probably Leahy will vote for Mukasey. He may hold his nose a little bit doing it, but he'll vote for him, and he'll try to make it better in his view, and Mukasey will try to do the same thing from his point of view.
Remember, before these hearings began, Chairman Leahy came out and said some things that were really quite summary in terms of what he expected to have happen and the acceptability he was anticipating from this nominee. He pretty much said, we expect to confirm him. Now he feels as though he may have bought into it a little bit too far, and when we hear about him talking about a loophole, it really sounded like Chairman Leahy thought it was more like the Cumberland Gap. And if he's found himself in a position where he can't vote against this guy, and yet he's giving him a kind of blank check that he does not want him to cash, well, they've got some things to work out.
Now, what about this question of the man who seemed a little bit less independent than he did on the first day? We just heard that comment from Mr. Leahy about maybe he got some instructions from the administration overnight, Leahy was suggesting, although Mukasey basically said, I had dinner with my family.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. There was one moment today where there was a sudden call for a break, and Mukasey said, I didn't call for a break. And then a couple of minutes later, he said, yeah, I need a break. One had the sense that they were wanted to get him in the back room and tell him something. What it was, I don't know. But, you know, in the long run, I just cannot imagine this getting as nasty as it was before. They're going
you
to
mean
be
the relationship Gonzalez, right. Attorney General Gonzalez, and this committee,
right? And the committee, and but I think Mukasey is going to have to try to do some things for Congress, deliver some information for oversight, because Republicans were very agitated about that today, and the question is, will he be able to do that? Will he find himself sort of isolated over at the Justice Department, or will he be a real player?
You know, whether he's getting any phone calls from the bench, as it were, or not, you know there are people in the White House, President's office, Vice President's office, who are watching these hearings and having much to say to each other, and whether or not they're in communication with this nominee, we can only speculate.
Thanks very much, Nina, Ron, and don't go away, because coming up we're going to take up the next most contentious issue of the day, which was domestic wiretapping. Please stay with us. You're listening to a special report from NPR News. Confirmation hearings on the president's choice to be the next attorney general, Judge Michael Mukasey of New York. We're breaking with our usual practice of reviewing the hearings in chronological order. Instead, we're spending time on topics that dominated the discussion. And in this part of the hour, we'll be hearing about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The senators will call it by its initials, FISA. President Bush, with the advice of his attorney general at the time, began a program of extensive secret wiretaps, starting with telephone conversations by people in the U.S. with people overseas, but almost immediately expanding into a much broader system of wiretaps. This was all right after 9/11. The Bush administration did not obtain warrants for this telephone surveillance, even though the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act provides for national security warrants to be obtained quickly and in secret. When Congress found out, the administration moved its program under the law. Now, that is a very bare-bones explanation of the context of the questioning you're about to hear, starting with Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who's the ranking Republican.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, that provides that the exclusive procedure for obtaining a wiretap is to go and get a warrant on probable cause. Was the president permitted to violate FISA because of his Article II powers, or was his violation of FISA a violation of law?
I'm not sure what violation it is we're talking about. If we're talking about the terrorist surveillance program, I think I said yesterday and
talking about the terrorist surveillance program, which has warrantless wiretaps, contrasted with FISA, which says the exclusive procedure to have a wiretap is to get a warrant. Now, what the president did violates FISA. Is it justifiable on his Article II powers? Because well, that's the question.
As I understand it, the president believed at the time and still believes that FISA was not the only applicable statute, that part of that he was acting with authorization under the authorization for the use of military force. I understand that there is more than one view on that.
I don't think anybody ever really seriously contended that our resolution of September 14th authorizing the use of force encompassed a violation of FISA.
Now we have two sets of initials to keep in mind, FISA and the resolution Congress passed giving the president the authority to go to war against Afghanistan, which senators call AUMF, or Authorization of the Use of Military Force. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, went into great detail about what is actually involved in FISA, how the courts are open 24/7, how it's all set up to do exactly what the administration wanted to do. She said there was no need to go outside the law and that any gaps in the law could be easily fixed. Here's Mukasey's response.
The only place where we might conceivably have a disagreement, and I'm not certain we do there either, is in the view that notwithstanding the Congress saying specifically, we are restricting the president's, what might otherwise be the president's authority under the Constitution, that can actually restrict the president's authority under the Constitution. Whether a past Congress said, we acknowledge the president's that the president might have authority that lies beyond this statute, to repeal that can't change the constitutional reality. If, however, it was always possible for the president to act within FISA, then there's no need for that authority. And, for example, under FISA as it stands now, as I understand it, there are procedures that are approved by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that the president is then free to use without each time having to go for a separate warrant, because that's simply unfeasible regardless of how many judges we've got. And that's obviously the way to go. That's the way I want to go.
Exactly. My point is this. The administration didn't try to do that. Before the heat got very hot, and then they went and did it. And that's the reason why FISA really should be the exclusive authority for this kind of public action, because it is all hidden action. And therefore, the Fourth Amendment does come into play, I think, too. So perhaps, you know, the best I can say for your argument, and it's wonderful for me because I'm not a lawyer, so I can say that, is that you have two budding amendments, perhaps. But when you listed the AUMF, I think the history counters the AUMF. That's all I wanted to make. Thank you.
The Congress is currently working on a redo of FISA, reauthorization of the act. The Bush administration is pushing for all those telephone companies and others who did as they were asked by the administration and helped out with the warrantless wiretaps to be immune from prosecution. Chairman Leahy, exercising his prerogative, chimed in on that as well. He said the administration claims that no laws were broken, but in fact they know better.
I think the fact that they're bringing so much pressure on the Intelligence Committee, and it presses to be believed the Intelligence Committee is about to cave on this and bringing pressure on this committee to immunize past illegal conduct, is because they know that it was illegal conduct and that there is no saving grace for the president to say, well, I was acting with authority. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so much pressure on us to immunize illegal conduct by either people acting within our government or within the private industry.
Although he wanted to discuss the journalist shield law that Congress is considering, Arizona Republican Senator John Kyle jumped in as well on the FISA issue, saying that there may be very good reasons to take care of telephone companies and others.
With all due respect, let me suggest there is another way to read the president's strong interest in trying to get a good FISA reauthorization, a much more benign reason. That he believes that it's important to our national security that we be able to secure this intelligence information against terrorists, and with regard to the retroactive liability, that there could be a very chilling effect on the ability of telephone companies or others to cooperate with the government if we don't protect them from potential suit. It doesn't have to be that the administration knew that its activities were illegal, and therefore it has been working with us hard to get this legislation passed. In fact, I think that's a most uncharitable and incorrect assessment of the situation.
All this discussion of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, comes down to why the president did not pursue wiretaps under the act and whether he broke the law when he did not use the secret FISA courts to get warrants for those wiretaps and whether he did have the authority to ignore that law. Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin, a Democrat, went more deeply into that with Judge Mukasey.
The Supreme Court has held that executive power is affected very significantly by what Congress does. So it sounds like overnight you've gone from being agnostic, as you and I have gone back and forth since our first meeting on this question, to holding what is a rather disturbing view. You've said today that you believe the president may violate a statute if he is acting within his Article II authority. Now that position, which I find alarming, makes it extremely important to know what you believe the exact scope of the president's Article II authority to be. So are you telling the committee, Judge, that any time the president is acting to safeguard the national security against a terrorist threat, he does not have to comply with statutes?
You've suggested that I've gone overnight from being an agnostic to being a heretic. And
explain why you haven't.
I haven't. I think all I'm saying is that I recognize the force of Justice Jackson's three-step approach. But I recognize also that each branch has its own sphere of authority that is exclusive to it. For example, just to take an example that has nothing to do with the subject under discussion immediately, you have the exclusive authority to vote me up or vote me down for any reason or no reason. If I am displeased with the result and displeased with the reason, I could not validly go down the street to the courthouse and file a lawsuit and claim that I had been denied a right, even if I got some judge who was willing to entertain the lawsuit and even if I prevailed. There are a lot of ways you could describe that outcome, but the rule of law isn't one of them, because the authority belongs only to you. There are areas of presidential authority. I also said that we are not dealing here with necessarily with areas of black and white. I understand that, which is why it's very important that push not come to shove on these questions, because the result can be not simply discord, but disaster.
Senator Feingold concluded by suggesting that if he's confirmed, the new attorney general might do something about the administration's notions of ever-expanding power of the president. Again, a contentious point in the hearing, somewhat softened by Senator Feingold's statement that he respects Judge Mukasey and expects him to be confirmed. And despite the testy nature of parts of today's hearing, Chairman Leahy ended the questioning of Judge Mukasey with what seemed to be an assumption of his eventual confirmation.
This committee and both parties are ready and willing to work with you. I think we've already begun. And Judge, I don't mean to take the last word here. If you want to add something to that before we go to the next panel, please feel free.
I couldn't add in any way that would improve it. The only thing I can tell you is that if you ultimately do repose trust in me, I'm going to spend the next however many months it is trying to vindicate that trust. I'm very grateful to you for this. Thank you.
Judge Michael Mukasey, who has been nominated to be the next Attorney General, and I think we can pretty much conclude from what Patrick Leahy said that everyone expects him to be confirmed. Ron Elving, who is NPR Senior Washington Editor, and Nina Totenberg, NPR's Legal Affairs Correspondent, are here. Let me ask you, first of all, this is the second time in the hearing that Judge Mukasey has said that it's important that push not come to shove on issues having to do with presidential power and the sort of the tussle between the Congress and the president over who has what power. He wants it to remain gray, is that it?
Well, but that's one of the problems here, is that when you have, in a situation like this anyway, where you have the president claiming certain powers and Congress is very limited in what it can do about restricting those powers. After all, Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to, in fact, have a check on presidential power. And when the president didn't like the check, or he ignored it. Similarly, you see this in the whole conversation about the conflict about executive privilege. So Congress, even under the Democrats' power, is somewhat limited in what it can do here. And yes, it's good if you don't have push come to shove, but the person who really has the power to push and to shove the most is almost always the president of the United States, if he's willing to take the heat, and this president is willing to take the heat.
Ron, I would say that as a political matter, which is the point of view that you and I both approach almost all everything from, it's excuse me, it is just simply more comfortable to not let push come to shove, because at this point it's a Republican president and the Democrats feel shoved. But then it could be a Democratic president.
Our system of government survives as well as it does because none of the co-equal or theoretically co-equal branches presses its case too far most of the time. And when one does, as in the case of Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, the pushback from both of the other two branches, and they were both pushing back very hard, not just Congress but also the judicial branch, was what frustrated him and brought him down. That is the way the system is designed to work. And there was a great deal of self-congratulation in our country after Watergate on the part of many people saying, say, this system that we've been operating under for almost 200 years works pretty well. And it does, and relative to other systems, of course, it has its flaws and it has its benefits. But it does require forbearance. Everybody in the game has to agree not to push too hard. What we've seen since 9/11 is a very strong effort by the White House, specifically by the president and the office of the vice president, to redefine the role of the executive much more aggressively than it has been pursued by almost any other president, with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War and some of our other wartime presidents, and exert these powers even in the absence of a specific declaration of war and even in the presence of certain very defining statutes like FISA, because they felt, and they have argued strongly, the special exigencies of this war on terror after 9/11 required it.
And the war on terror, the president seems to feel, justifies, because the nation is in peril, a whole series of decisions. Let me ask both of you what your take is on the sort of general edginess of today's hearing. It was a shift from yesterday, which was a much more sort of courteous and sort of iconic view of the law and this country as a nation of laws and so forth.
I don't think there's any doubt that Judge Mukasey was chosen for this job in large part because he agrees with the president on questions of national security. I think it's actually fairly obvious that he doesn't agree with this president about some other things involving domestic policy, involving the use, the way the Justice Department was used for rather political purposes. It's pretty clear to me that he, from questions today, he doesn't agree with this administration about in some measure about gay rights, even about the death penalty to some extent. But on this singular question, which is of paramount importance to this president, I think he basically does agree. And that was clear when the Democrats did push him to try to get some form to the sort of blurry picture they got in the first day. The form they saw was the same form that the president saw when he picked Michael Mukasey for this job.
Linda, let me oversimplify just for a moment to make a point.
Oh, good. That's good.
I think it's fair to say that the first day of these hearings was more about Alberto Gonzalez than it was about Michael Mukasey. They wanted essentially to get the specter, if you will, the carcass of all that controversy out of the way. They wanted to say, would you be like Al on this, and would you be like Al on this, and would you be different? And they got all that out of the way, and they were so happy to have somebody different that they essentially lavished praise on him. Today, we turn to Michael Mukasey. And as Nina says, Michael Mukasey is a lot closer to the president on these executive power issues, these Article II issues, than these fellows are comfortable with, and that's why things got testier today.
Very quickly, any do you see any change in his prospects from a day like today?
No.
His prospects for confirmation?
No. I mean, I think it gave some senators pause, but not enough pause to vote against him. There are only 15 months left in this administration. They need somebody to run the department. They can't have a rudderless branch enforcing the law of the land.
But they're going to shudder before they cast that vote because of some of the issues that were raised today.
Thanks a lot to both of you, NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and NPR's senior Washington editor Ron Elving. This special report was produced and edited by Marcus Rosenbaum with help from Scott Cameron, Nishant Dahiya, and Katie Adan. Our director is Gwyn Uten, and the studio engineer is Cal Southworth. I'm Linda Wertheimer, NPR News, Washington.